Thank you for listening to our Conversations About Change, bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. Here's this week's show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 203rd E10 Tech Community Call held on Monday, October 20th, 2008. E10 means Conversations About Change. I'm Jerry Mikulski, E10's founder. Today I'm in San Francisco, and my co-founder, Pip Coburn, is, I believe, on the East Coast. Every week, we take 30 to 35 minutes to discuss tech topics of interest to investors, executives, and tech-savvy folks like you. You can find supporting resources online at e10.com, that's y-i-t-a-n.com, as well as links to a live chat using Internet Relay Chat. As a many media operation, we tweet using the hash code #ye10, no hyphen, and we podcast, so you can listen to these conversations when you want to. This is an interactive call, which means we are all live together. Please be mindful of this and don't put us on your musical hold. Instead, use *6 on your keypad. When you want to jump in, the *6 combination will also uncloak you, and then please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's conversation about change lives at the intersection of telecommunications and development economics. I recently got wind through a mailing list I've been on for a very long time. Recently got wind of an interesting conference held at my alma mater, UC Irvine, on the topic of mobile digital money. It was titled Everyday Digital Money. Our guests today are its organizers, Irvine anthropologist Bill Moore and Intel researcher Scott Mainwaring. And I don't know if Scott's made it back onto the call yet. Bill was just sending him the updated call info. But Bill, I think you're there. And maybe a really nice way to start is just to define or get as close as we can to defining what digital money is in this case.
Great. Okay, Jerry. I'll do my best. That may be Scott right there now. But, you know, we took, in thinking about this conference, a very broad definition of digital money. We felt that there was a lot of activity going on in industry and in research around various kinds of new forms of electronic payment or digital currencies, everything from smart card-based technologies to cell phone-based mobile banking, as well as online financial activity and online banking communities, and as well as things like social lending. But that these had been all essentially siloed off into their own little communities and little worlds, and there weren't too many opportunities for crosstalk among these various constituencies and across these technology, industry, and design communities. So when we put together this call for proposals for the conference on everyday digital money, we were really looking for people who were working, you know, across the entire range of new forms of payment systems that involve any kind of digital or electronic communication technology that, you know, are relatively new to the scene. But, you know, when I say that we were looking at new and emerging things, we were also, and continue to be, very interested in good old-fashioned magstripe technology on the back of your credit card, because there's, you know, a whole array of things going on in the magstripe world, from various kinds of, you know, marketing of cards, but also new uses of cards and repurposing of cards that we were also very interested in. So, you know, for us, digital money really includes the gamut, the full range of payment and exchange media that are sort of going beyond paper currency and coin. And I should say, too, that we threw in the mix the whole world of alternative currencies, because so many of them had also involved some kind of technological fix. I can talk more about that if you like, but I guess for now, go ahead.
I was going to dive back into the magstripe thing a little bit and then also head into alternative currencies, because people don't know much about them, and I think current economic situations are just one large advertisement for alternative currencies, as far as I can tell.
Yes, indeed.
So just can you give us an idea of what sort of things are being done with magstripes?
Well, you know, mainly we were interested originally in the various ways in which people in the marketing community were thinking about, you know, how do you pitch a credit card to people, especially in both in difficult economic times, but also given the long-standing historical association of debt with really bad things, right? Most of the monotheistic religious traditions sort of have problems with interest-bearing debt. In our own country, there has been, you know, a kind of outcry against the way that credit cards lead people into rampant consumerism that they can never afford to support a lifestyle that is out of sync with their own income generation and so on. But at the same time, credit cards have become these sort of intensely personal and personalized recognizable things. So, the American Express card has always been marketed as something for, you know, the upper crust or the important people. That's sort of a long-standing thing. But we've seen various kinds of, you know, attempts at value marketing of credit cards to create new communities and new constituencies. So, for example, you know, a credit card with a pink ribbon for breast cancer research or a credit card for environmental causes. You know, these things started off mainly as a kind of marketing ploy, almost like a kind of skin, you know, on top of the credit card to signify something besides, you know, this is just a credit card.
Right.
But we've also seen the emergence of all of these sort of new programs involving credit cards, like the Keep the Change program, things that allow you to save, things that allow you to donate, you know, to round up and donate that amount to the cause of your choice, things that are in many ways helping to soften or even obviate this historical association of credit with bad stuff. And we were very interested in that. And, you know, just on the technological side, you know, the magnetic stripe can do a whole lot more than what it's used for, right? There's several tracks that go completely unused. And so we were interested in the way that folks maybe were thinking about what are some alternative uses of those other tracks, what other kinds of data could be put in them, or what other ways could the data be gotten out. You know, we're big fans of an artist, and I'll just sort of give her a little shout-out here, Kate Bingham and Burt. Her name is Kate Bingham and Burt, and she has a website called obsessiveconsumption.com. One of the things that she does in her work is she makes drawings of her credit card statements and then sells them for the minimum balance due, right? And this is sort of a commentary on obsessive consumption, but also a really interesting reflection on the sorts of data that credit cards make available to people. You know, right
now,
there
was an artist that used to do this with dollar bills, right?
Oh, well, there's a long tradition in the U.S. of money artists. There's, you know, Boggs, of course, is the famous contemporary living artist, but Otis Kay in the 19th century and early 20th century, there's a whole bunch of people who do that, mainly to comment on the kind of fictionality of value, the way in which the dollar is itself a kind of work of art with nothing backing it except, you know, the sort of faith of people
who use poignant.
It. So, especially now.
Yeah, exactly. And so Kate is actually doing that, but for credit cards?
But for credit cards. And what's interesting there is, you know, the credit card gives you, if you choose to use it, an entire map of your network of transactions, right? If you're using the credit card for virtually everything, you have then in your statement a roadmap of you, of your life, of what you've been doing, of some of the relationships that sustain you. They may or may not be necessarily meaningful relationships, but somehow, you know, what Bingham and Burt is trying to do is draw them out and say, you know, look, that $1.50 cup of coffee you put on your credit card, even though you did it without thinking, is part of what it was that made you today.
Right.
So she's thinking about the diverse ways that all the sorts of information embodied in the credit card statement can be repurposed, can be put to new ways of reflecting about your position in the world, thinking about yourself as a person, and then for her also new ways of thinking about art and what art is and can do.
Fascinating. Let's come back. I just wanted to sort of paint the waterfront a little more. And then if Scott's on the line, I wanted to bring him into the conversation as well. Scott, have you made it onto the call?
Yes, I have.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. And Scott, what was your particular perspective on the conference, or what aspects of the conference were most interesting to you?
Well, I'm someone who has a background in computer science on one hand and psychology and social science on the other. So I've long been interested in the kind of doing a mashup between these two worlds that often don't have a lot of intersection or reason to talk to each other. And it seems like the idea of money and of digital money and of what it means culturally is something that's as important to a technologist trying to understand how to plan for the infrastructure for this century for financial transactions, as it is to an anthropologist studying how the meaning of money is evolving as cultures evolve and practices evolve.
Exactly. It's funny, I got really interested in behavioral economics a few years ago and had as a friend, sort of a business friend, a pretty senior executive at Schwab, and was talking with him about, hey, why don't you create an alternative interface for trading where you get behavioral econ benefits. First of all, you get sort of an analysis about what are you weak in, what are you susceptible to, and then do things like, hey, if you'll place the closing trade when you place the opening trade, we'll give you a 50% discount on the trade. A variety of things that might be incentives or inducements to behave less crazily. Are we seeing this also with mobile platforms?
I think we're seeing hints of it. I was talking to a Tokyo-based blogger who was he was more lamenting the fact that in Japan there are attempts to put credit cards, which are even kind of more stigmatized within Japanese culture than they are here, to embed credit cards onto your cell phone, which does open up the possibility of using the display on that cell phone to do just very simple things like maybe posting how much you've charged that month, so as a reminder, something to reflect on, that would really potentially really resonate with people's concerns. But in fact, the technology that's been deployed is not taking advantage of the doesn't seem to fully understand that it's living on a cell phone now. It's very much sort of a bare bones functionality. But I think that's a huge opportunity that the technology field has.
May I make a comment? This is Ed Pimentel on the very same subject. What we're seeing, that there's a huge opportunity in being able to finance and add value, store value to a phone based upon human behavior. And what we have been working on, a number of companies, is one, rather than credit cards, so credit cards is in the mix, is prepay to attach it to a phone. And then also being able for them to add value to their wallet, their electronic wallet, based upon certain things that they do, maybe online. If they identify themselves to like shoes and like coffee, then the merchant may be able to target specific apps to them, and then they can build loyalty points, and those loyalty points can be added to their phone. Other ways, now they can make purchases. Other ways to be able to add value, to be able to then use it for other purposes is based upon a declared value of their net worth. So in other words, the ability to bring other people into a specific community. And then we also worked with someone almost along the line of what the gentleman said earlier, being able to what the banking company do today if you go in the point of sale. So we're working with a company called My Retirement Rewards. So basically, we push coupons to their phones, and then to be able to make purchases, and those actual purchases, a certain value of that then is added to for retirement, for savings, almost like a way of for savings, or for them to later use.
This is Ed Pimentel, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Sure. And what was the name of that site again? My Something Rewards?
My Retirement Rewards is the company that we're working with to do that. And then we also work with another company where we actually have a 2D barcode. And the 2D barcode, can be used for many things, right? The 2D barcode is basically a value. It has a certain value. 2D barcode is used being able to enter into a movie theater or to enter into a specific conference or a specific event, right? We're talking to a company that is introducing us to ESPN. Actually, we're doing a demo tomorrow night where basically be able to lower fraud by using 2D barcodes and a social network that you actually create for that individual, and only that individual only, where we control it, so they aren't able to pass that ticket to someone else. So the way that it works,
you're going a little too deep here, and I need to get back to what we're talking about. I really appreciate your contributions, though, and in fact, you're reminding me of an artifact from the future that Jason Tester at the Institute for the Future created some time ago, which was a make-believe movie ticket, where once you buy your movie ticket, on the movie ticket is printed a little map of your friends who are also in the theater, basically a little piece of your social graph in the theater. So it's interesting that you're doing all these different kinds of ventures. Let me go back to Joel and Scott for a second, though. Can we dive into alternative currencies for a second? And then I want to go back and open the phone line to everybody to jump in.
Sure. Should I take that, Scott?
Sure.
Yeah, please.
All right, yeah. We tried to incorporate the alternative currency world into our conference because, you know, many alternative currency systems in the U.S. and elsewhere initially start as barter networks. And barter networks have a long history. People have been doing them for years and years and years, hundreds of years even. They sometimes are more formal. They sometimes are more informal. What was interesting to us was the way that some of them got formalized in particular ways in the 70s and 80s, right around the same time that people were beginning to think about the possibilities of computer technology. So, you know, in a traditional barter network, you have someone who usually is some kind of central accounts keeper who's paying attention to who's doing what for whom. If you think of like a simple babysitting circle, you know, who's minding the kids this week and who's going to do it next week, and that accountant sort of has to make sure that what comes around goes around and that there's no sort of free riders or mm-hmm. no people who aren't sort of doing their fair share or no one who's being unduly burdened. Some folks in the 70s and 80s were beginning to think about the ways that, you know, you could use a computer to be that central accounts keeper and you could virtualize the whole business of accounting altogether. We had at our conference Michael Linton, right. who's a Vancouver-based guy who's arguably the founder or inventor of so-called LETS systems. And LETS sometimes is held to stand for Local Exchange and Trading System or Local Energy Transfer System. There's a bunch of words that, you know, the acronym can refer to. And LETS, the way that Linton envisioned them, essentially function in that way, with some kind of accounts keeping that's done on computer. And what's interesting there is you really get a picture of where value comes from, right? Value mm-hmm. is generated here by people doing things for each other without any official currency intervening. The currency, in effect, is the ledger ticks that the computer is keeping track of.
Right. I remember seeing Linton do a presentation years ago where he showed a graph, and I remember at the end of the presentation thinking, oh my God, there's absolutely no way I could explain what I was just shown right here to anybody else, but it really does seem to work, and you know,
yeah.
it's installed and up and running in lots of different places. It was brilliant, but to me, impenetrable.
Yeah. it can get pretty complicated pretty quickly, especially if you have a lot of people involved or if you have
right.
separate networks that overlap. But essentially, it's a kind of way of, you know, what we would call it now would be a social networking kind of tool, specifically harnessed to generate value, value that's often not denominated in monetary terms. And we were interested in bringing the alternative currency people into the mix because so much of what we see going on around the world, especially in the mobile space, but elsewhere too, is people coming up on their own with their own sort of paracurrencies or quasi-currencies. For example, a famous example would be the use of airtime minutes as a kind of currency. So people have airtime minutes on their phone and can have the ability to send them to somebody else's phone. That person can then either use them or cash them out at a kiosk for actual money. So, you know, we wanted people like Linton there so that we could be thinking more about possibilities beyond the kind of state-backed currency and or sort of corporate framework within which a lot of new payment systems are being developed. And I should say that what's interesting is, you know, you have these sort of counter-movements that have emerged, counter-movements to LETS that have emerged in the States and elsewhere since LETS systems have taken off. And a classic example there would be the Ithaca Hour program, where because of a sense that a LETS makes everything public, there's no anonymity, people wanted a kind of return to the anonymity of paper currency. And so in Ithaca, what was a LETS system turned into a paper-based alternative currency with, you know, pure anonymity and a kind of currency circulating in parallel to the U.S. dollar for transactions.
Thank you for framing that.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for framing it that way because I had no idea that Ithaca Hours were sort of a counter movement to LETS. That was really interesting. Sorry, Scott, go ahead, jump in.
I would just add that a lot of the innovation that's going on has an alternative currency feel to it, but in the sense of having to be alternative. being forced to be alternative, as opposed to some of the community currency movements, which have a you know, sort of an ideological reason why they want to be alternative. So
right.
You see things like in China, we did a study of a currency called Qcoins, which is an online currency that a large kind of a game portal there, instant messaging portal in China, had to invent in order to allow lots of its users who didn't have credit cards or other means of doing small payments to get into the system to make the business work. They had to invent some way of doing that. So they invented Qcoins, which have a one-to-one relationship with the RMB, the official national currency. And it sort of surfaced on the radar screen a couple years ago because the Chinese Central Bank started taking an interest in, okay, what is this second currency happening in China? And
right.
That's not really, is that really in the interest of the Chinese people? And brought a lot of this kind of scrutiny. And I think that example illustrates the situation a lot of innovators find themselves in, of needing to innovate, but also needing to be very careful about sort of playing under the radar so that they don't end up challenging, running afoul of banking regulations and sort of the established non-alternative currency players coming in and kind of stomping out the innovation.
So in some way, your conference was a little bit of an applied computer freedom and privacy conference, like one of the old CFP cons, it sounds like, because as some people who are building alternative currencies of this kind, there's this need to stay under the radar, as you're saying. You can't emerge too far. In particular, in China, so few people have credit cards, and few people have ongoing accounts on their cell phones. I think it's vastly prepaid, that the government loses the ability to find out who's who and who's using what. In particular, you could easily swap phones, you know, pass around numbers, have codes, do whatever else, and you could really anonymize yourself back into the crowd.
Right, and in some ways it may be in the government's interest to semi-legitimize Qcoin so that it does give an ability to have some monitoring and ability to track what's going on in the actual economy of China instead of just the official level.
Interesting. Although if it's pegged one-to-one to the RMB, it seems like it can't float, it can't do its own thing. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Anyway, I also wanted to invite people on the call to dive in. We've eaten up much of the time of the call, but ask questions. I think we have a bunch of people who dialed in with different sorts of interest on the subject.
Mr. Karpinski.
Hey, Dick.
One thing I was thinking about was having cooperative ventures like Experts Exchange, but where if you do a good job for somebody, they give you some kudos, and kudos then might eventually be monetized. But I also have to mention that I have a sister on Salt Spring Island in Canada, and they have a local currency which features images from local artists on actual paper money that looks really good and is usable in all the shops and banks on the island.
Yep.
What's the island again?
Salt Spring Island.
Salt Spring.
And they have ones and twos and fives and tens in paper.
Yep.
Yeah, this is Scott Meanwaring. I actually have a few examples of that in my possession. It's just stunningly beautiful, which actually raises a problem. It may be actually too beautiful for its own good, because you can run into deflationary pressures as the currency is treated not as a currency but as an art object to be collected and sent off the island for hard cash coming into the island.
That's very funny.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say that that deflation has actually been a problem for the Ithaca Hour system for precisely the same reason. Right, people go there and see it and think, oh, wow, this is cool, and then take it home, taking it out of circulation.
Yep. What is the frontier right now? What sort of what are the leading edges that are being tested, and if you can point to any of these experiments? We've already listed a few of them on the call, but where else should we look for what's happening here?
Well, I just got back from a Silicon Valley industry marketing get-together called the Virtual Goods Summit, there's a whole bunch of startups playing with reward points online, trying to act as service providers to people who are creating virtual worlds, advertising themselves as, well, you don't have time to really become the Alan Greenspan or whoever the appropriate person to point to is at this point of running your virtual world's economy. Give your virtual world's economy over to us, and we'll run it for you. So a whole bunch of different kinds of business models emerging out of the success of Facebook and MySpace and things that have caught the attention of the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley.
That's really interesting. Ed, do you want to jump back into the call? Is this the kind of thing that you're doing, that you're building? Do you want to be the currency system for an online space, for example, an online world?
Well, actually, we've been there about 2 years. If you go to Second Life, you notice that there's a company called Agile Pay, and that's us. We're trying to basically just team up with Hip Hop that created an island, and we're going to be able to be the currency that people can buy, Lindy dollars, using Agile Pay.
Cool. And so your company is Agile Co., and you have a bunch of sub-companies, basically working in this space, right?
Oh, you're crazy. Yeah, so Agile Pay is payment, and Good Wallet is basically banking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very cool. Does anybody on the call want to hazard whether the current financial crisis means a large swing toward alternative currencies, or are they just going to keep growing at the normal organic rate of growth that they're seeing right now? Is there a reason for governments to step in and do things, or is there a government in the world that seems interested in experimenting out of the normal currency realm, or is that just too taboo, too off the beaten path for them?
Well, this is Bill. I'll maybe say something here. I think one of the things that we are already seeing because of the financial crisis is, first of all, a heightened sense of people's financial literacy or illiteracy. People are talking about these things in a way that they haven't for a long time. But also, around the world, in the States and elsewhere, poor people for a long time have been doing lots of things that we would consider alternative with their financial practices or with their money, involving, hacks of existing systems or mashups of different kinds of systems to serve some kind of saving or lending or money transfer kind of function. And I think the way that these things had been going before the financial crisis was that things that people were doing, out there in the world, pretty much among the sort of lowest classes of people, were being noticed by corporate industry actors and harnessed for other kinds of product design and provision. And I think we can probably see that heightening right now, right? So there may be people now in the States who are thinking about prepaid more than using their credit card, for example, and I bet you that there are going to be people who want to get in on that space. There's already been, at the kind of banking level, there had been for some time a shift away from generating an income stream for your financial institution based on just, good old-fashioned investment and interest, and toward small fee-based things, right? So toward micro fees. The poorer people get, or the poorer people feel, the more that those sorts of micro fee type things can become your revenue stream.
Exactly. You just get a little sliver off of a lot of different things. And then it occurs to me also that governments may be more predisposed to crack down on alternative currencies the more doubts about the normal currency system exist. So it could swing either way as far as I'm thinking right now. Other questions on the call, or other opinions about whether this swings large? Jump on in. *6 will unquote you. Stefan, did you want to jump in? Stefan Somogyi was on the call. He's done lots of stuff in this space as well.
I will confess, no, not really. I've been absorbing all this information and need some time to digest it. The only comment I made earlier on the IRC channel is there was some discussion about the Japanese looking at embedding credit cards into their mobile phones. That perplexes me a little because the Japanese don't really need to do that. They've got all of this FIDICA-based stuff, this near-field communication, and they're actually using their mobile phones as payment systems, as prepaid payment systems, and a huge number of applications. It's similar in some ways to the New York City MTA system, where you can use your MTA card to buy a bagel, buy a paper, buy some coffee. The Japanese are doing something very, very similar in that you preload value into these cards, and not only do you swipe them as you enter the mass transit system, but you can also use them to some extent in the surroundings. So I guess I'd be slightly curious to hear what anyone thinks is the added value of actually putting credit card plumbing into a mobile phone versus what they've already got.
Yeah, this is Scott. The research that I did with colleagues in Japan was exactly looking at the Felica space, and it's a really huge success story. Probably one of the best examples of a electronic currency really becoming integrated into daily life. The credit card schemes, I think there's one called ID, little I, capital D, very hard to Google for, these schemes that are attempting to become Felica currencies, but essentially ways of tying credit card payments into that existing and successful system in Japan. And they haven't been particularly particularly successful. In terms of why you'd want to do that, I guess my speculation, or my sort of putting my designer hat on, is that it would be a way for credit card companies to try to have the best of both worlds, of having access to payment systems that people are actually using, but in a way that is reassuring the people that their risks are being addressed. That's sort of an opportunity. One way that it is being deployed is sort of a beginner's credit card. So there's, for young people, like their first credit card, part of the way it's being marketed is this is a way of, you know, that you're waving your cell phone over the terminal is kind of a cool, youthful thing to do, and this is a way of getting the credit card, getting their foot in the door into kind of getting people at the right life stage to start thinking about that as an alternative payment.
Very interesting. One question. Sorry, go ahead, dive in.
Yeah, I'd like to add this comment regarding alternative methods. Recently we spoke with someone that he's talking to a number of entertainments where they're going to be selling CDs with actually 2D or 1D barcode, as well as T-shirts. When the individual buys that CD, DVD, or T-shirts, then they're able to allocate certain amounts of dollars, you know, that they actually become store value to the phone, and then they can download additional products and services. So basically it's one way to actually add value to a phone they can use as currency.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. One thing that comes back to me as I think about all these different things, and we've talked about pseudo-currencies like frequent flyer miles and airtime minutes and Second Life in-world dollars, Linden dollars, and other virtual dollars. We keep touching on things. And I come back to two things. One is, what is value and how do we bank value? The asset value. You know, when you light up your phone, the 630 minutes that are there, that's actually value in that world, but not all that transferable or usable except within that network. But then the second thing is, how do we attach this to identity? And is it, you know, that phone, if somebody can figure out the codes on it, is worth cash? Is there a way to attach all this stuff to your identity so that it can only be transferred when you are present or when you authorize it? And so we can start to bank on our identities more. Is there work being done in those areas?
Can I take 30 seconds? Actually, I just had a meeting with a company that we're doing this using voice biometrics. And though we haven't had much success with Western Union, we met with Western Union at a top level because they're moving on to get a thousand and thousand what they call virtual merchants to be able to do that. So what happens, the minute that you move currency into a phone, you need to identify really who that person is. And so think about even in Africa where someone, they get their payroll actually deposited in some credit cards, need to access it. Well, the PIN is almost, it's not secure, but if you can actually authorize the payment and the transfer of money using your voice, that's biometric, your voice is one of the five points of biometrics that can be used remotely as opposed to fingerprint, iris, and palm.
Interesting. And, architecturally, whether that's centralized or decentralized means a lot for personal security and national security. Bill or Scott, did you want to jump in on this?
Well, sorry. I didn't want to interrupt those guys.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, this is Bill, that, on the whole question of what is value anyway and how is value tied to identity, I mean, I think that one of the things that some of these emerging payment systems help us to see better is that value has always been relational and relationally based. A lot of the things that we see going on in the world in the money and payment space has to do with taking people's existing informal social relationships and somehow harnessing them to capture some of the value that already exists in them. Value is, quintessentially a human phenomenon. It's not something that, comes from on high. It's something that we do and we make in our activities and interactions with others. And what we see these technologies enabling is a way of other people kind of getting into the value that's created through those relationships, to harness it, to amplify it, maybe to transfer it or transform it into another kind of state that other people can then use. You mentioned that, you have certain kinds of quasi-currencies that aren't transferable. And I don't necessarily, think that's a problem. One of the things that I always say over and over again, like a broken record, is that, we all do quite fine right now with lots and lots of different non-interoperable currencies in our wallets, right? We just sort of take out what's in your wallet right now. You've got a lot of things that can't talk to each other. And we use those boundaries for different social purposes. And I think it's important always to sort of keep front and center that when we're talking about value or money or currency of any kind, we're talking primarily about a social relationship.
That's fascinating. Thank you. That syncs a lot with stuff I've been looking into lately as well. We didn't get a chance. We've run over our time as we always do, and I'm going to wind us out of the call in a little bit. I just wanted to ask one more question. Bill, you have a lot of expertise in Islamic finance and these notions of taking interest and changing it into other sorts of calculations and so on. And that was only the second time I'd heard somebody talk about Islamic finance, and then yesterday over lunch I heard about it yet again. And in the context of it being actually a large force in the world and being one of the reasons why the current financial system is a little antsy, do you see Islamic finance as sort of large and rising or small and sort of trying to find its way? Or what's the role here worldwide for Islamic finance?
Well, worldwide it's still very much trying to find its way. I mean, you have these sort of two counterposing tendencies in Islamic finance in the past 10 or so years. One is a very strong community development sort of focus, focusing primarily on sort of, small-scale, local stuff, both around, mosque building, but also around helping people provide for their basic daily needs and provide for housing and loans and things they might need to start a business. But then there's sort of the kind of big money Islamic banking, which is primarily driven by, the vast sums of wealth that people are accumulating in oil-producing countries,
and that are
sort of seeking some kind of outlet in some kind of enterprise around the world in a way that is in accordance, at least on paper, in accordance with the Islamic prohibition of interest.
Right.
And these two things are these two tendencies are very different animals, and sometimes sort of come together, and other times sort of fly apart. And I think, really, we have yet to see, what this will mean. I mean, I do think that the sorts of contractual forms that Islamic banking tends to take, whether at the small scale or the large scale level, in these kind of economic times, does seem to lend a certain kind of stability, because generally stuff is asset-backed. Generally, contracts involve a profit and loss sharing arrangement instead of debt built on debt built on debt.
Right.
These things can weather these particular sorts of credit crises better than our sort of quote-unquote conventional finance can. But as to whether that's going to be kind of world-changing or not, I think it remains to be seen.
Yeah. Are there derivatives in Islamic finance?
There can be, yes. I don't know if I can explain it to you in the time that we have.
And we don't have that much time left on this call, but I was just curious whether they even exist. So yes, it's complicated enough and there's less enough that you can start to peel away parts of the asset or parts of the transaction.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I let me offer both of you a last word if you'd like, and if not, I'll summarize what we covered on the call and take us out. If there's anything else you'd like to have us think about or some subject you thought we'd cover or didn't cover or anything like that.
Well, I think I'll just riff a little bit on Bill's comment about how boundaries and lack of easy exchange can actually be features. I think another sort of traditional drawback of alternative currencies is that they're not considered real. They're not considered they're considered toys at some level, or have a lack of reality or seriousness to them. And I think in a similar way, especially in these troubling economic times, a little playfulness and ability to kind of think about money at a distance and not take it so damn seriously is also something that's human and important and not to be lost in all the seriousness.
Thank you. I love that point.
Hear, hear.
Terrific. Yeah. Bill?
No, that's it. I was just saying hear, hear.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think I'll leave it to you to wrap up at this point.
Great. That was a really nice concluding note. Thanks, Scott. So we started out with Bill talking about how at the conference, at the Everyday Digital Money Conference, and the link is in the invite, they took a really broad definition of what digital money might be, because there's tons of industry research, and there's all sorts of smart cards and cell phone banking and social lending and online money services and so forth. But basically, they're all siloed off from each other. And they were trying to figure out what is the range of forms of payment, and how do we look at some funny little corners, like magstripes or what Ed Simmental also mentioned, which is 2D barcodes and so on and so forth. And then also the large and interesting and quirky and possibly very fruitful world of alternative currencies. So we've sort of bounced around between those different subjects during the call. And so there's some programs now that are taking the magstripe on cards and doing things like keep the change or forced donations or enforced savings and so forth. There's also empty tracks still on that magstripe that could keep interesting information. We had a little brief excursion into money artists. Kate Bingham and Burke is doing drawings of credit cards and using those as payment. There are some old-time money artists who are pretty famous, Boggs and Otis Kay, and so forth. This is a really interesting meditation on the notion that we exchange these little bits of paper for value, and in fact they aren't backed by anything. So here are artists making that statement. Then this comment that the credit card gives you a map of your life, that really your transactions, your motions, et cetera, and through the entire call we started talking about, you know, the MTA card, for example, and I lived in Hong Kong for a while where they have the Octopus card. All of your movements are traced, and so the big brothery side of this is phenomenal, and then the possibilities for relationship and social network and progress are phenomenal as well. This topic clearly cuts both ways. Scott jumped in and said that he did a mashup, a blend of his computer science and psych social science background, and looking at what money means in different ways. I asked him about behavioral economics, and there's some hints of it, and he talked a little bit about Japan trying to blend credit cards, which have a worse rep in Japan than they do in the U.S., and embed them into cell phones, where you could use the display to say, hey, you know, you're way over your limit this month, or even just the reinforcement of seeing how much you've charged this month, and so forth. Then Ed Pimentel jumped in. He's with AgileCo, and he's got a bunch of different things, including AgilePay, which is a payment system that works, in fact, within Second Life to exchange Lyndon dollars. And he talked about a whole variety of ways of adding value to phones based on human behaviors and human technologies. He's focused mostly on prepaid cards, not credit cards, and trying to figure out how to add value based on what people do, so you could collect up your loyalty points for your behavior online, sort of clickstream tracking, and then you get a benefit from some added minutes on your phone, for example, or the ability to create retirement rewards. There's a site called My Retirement Rewards where it does this for savings kind of thing. Then we went back and looked into alternative currencies, and Bill was describing how a lot of barter systems got formalized in the 70s and 80s when computers were just starting, and that you need some kind of accounts keeper in the middle to figure out, you know, how much money there is out there. And that seems to have gotten computerized in different ways. And then he brought Michael Linton into the picture, and Linton is one of the leaders in this world of alternative currencies and LETs, local exchange trading systems. It actually turns out that there are many different interpretations for what LETs stands for. and how we're starting to figure out how to derive value from these social networks and social relationships. This is not necessarily money. There are also do-it-yourself quasi-currencies like airtime minutes and so forth, where you can even cash out of airtime minutes at some different place. In fact, one of the first places I got interested in all this was Ethan Zuckerman talking about a transaction in Ghana of how somebody was sending money to their mother in a remote village by, you know, reading out phone prepaid card numbers to the phone lady in his mother's village. So this is, in some cases, moving beyond state and corporate frameworks in really interesting ways. Small footnote, I didn't realize that that Ithaca Hours was actually sort of a counter-movement against Let's, because Let's, there's very little anonymity in Let's. In local exchange trading systems, you can see what everybody's doing, and in Ithaca Hours, you're back to paper that seems like currency and has the anonymity of currency as well. We talked a little bit about China and Qcoins, which are sort of a parallel ghost currency next to the RMB and are pegged one-to-one to it, and about how some players in this realm need to be very careful to play under the radar and not bounce their heads up too far lest they be pounded down like a whack-a-mole. Dick Karpinski jumped in and talked about how kudos can also be a currency, where people in cooperating ventures can give kudos to each other. Tara Hunt is just about to publish a book about Woofie, which was a term coined by Cory Doctorow in one of his books. Woofie is this notion of social currency like that. And he also mentioned that he has a sister in Salt Springs Island who, where there is a local currency with very nice bills. And in fact, Scott talked about how sometimes the bills are too beautiful and you get deflation as people start to go collect these bills and take them out of circulation. There's a virtual goods summit coming up around this. Reminded me also of Ed Castronova, who's a real authority on money exchange inside of social world, and how at this virtual goods summit they're looking at reward points online and different service providers just to virtual world, how this all works. So that seems to be part of the leading edge. That's when Ed jumped in and talked about his Agile Pay company and what they're doing. Then Bill talked also about how there's more literacy now. People are understanding at a much deeper level what's going on here, and also that poor people have been improvising these sorts of things for a very, very long time. They've been hacking and mashing up their own stuff for years and years and years. There may be a shift away. Then we talked a little bit more about the Japanese transactions. Stefan jumped in and asked about near-field communication systems and so forth and the MTA. And then Scott replied that his research in Japan was about Telica, this particular system, and trying to think about why would a credit card company play here. Mostly it seemed like it was for the credit card company's benefit to be able to play there. Then we talked a little bit about value and assets and what that all means, with a little interjection about voice biometrics from Ed again, who's doing something there. And Bill says that value is really relational, that we're trying to take these existing informal relationships and capture some of their value, which could take us into another U10 call very, very easily. So we talked then briefly about Islamic finance and how it's split into two very different communities, one which is sort of local, strong community development, where you're trying to fund the mosque or pay small loans or feed people in the local community, and then the other, which is very, very different. It's about big money, some of the sovereign wealth funds and other kinds of large fortunes trying to figure out where to invest while still remaining consistent with Sharia law, which says there shouldn't be interest. So a lot of the contractual forms here have possibly inherently more stability than our traditional derivatives and derivatives on derivatives, because they're asset-based and they have profit and loss sharing in different ways. But in that world, there are some derivatives, even though they are complicated. So Scott pointed out at the end that in Bill's riff on the boundaries and lack of exchangeability between something, these can actually be features. So in some sense, the decoupling of currency systems one from the other might actually be a great thing. And also, keeping alternative currencies as seeming not real and as seeming like toys might actually be good. A little playfulness and distance might be healthy and human ways to preserve the kinds of things that make alternative currency systems really productive for everybody. That was a lot of stuff we covered. That brings us to the end of Everyday Digital Money, the 203rd U10 Tech Community Call on Monday, October 20th, 2008. Bill, Scott, thank you very, very much, and Ed for jumping in, and Stefan and everybody else, and thank you all for joining us. Feel free to add comments and pages on u10.com, and please tell your colleagues to join us again next Monday when we'll have another conversation about change. Topic is actually still up in the air. I'm Jerry Mikulski. Thanks again, and until next week, goodbye, everybody.
This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Merkailo. Thanks again for listening.